dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a high honor and great privilege to have a career intelligence professional in the house, virtually, that is, the president of the Center for Security Policy. His name is Fred Flights, but he has spent most of his distinguished professional career in government service, working in or monitoring the doings of the U.S. intelligence community, notably at the Central Intelligence Agency, at the State Department, at the House Intelligence Committee, and not least as the Chief of Staff of the National Security Council of the United States. Fred, it is always good to have you with us. A lot to talk about. Welcome back. You had a good piece in National Review earlier this week about the ongoing drama in the United Nations concerning the sanctions on Iran. And for those of us who haven't been following it as closely as you have, and few people have over a longer period of time more closely followed Iran than you, Fred, give us kind of an up-to-the-minute, blow-by-blow description of where we stand with respect to these sanctions and the United Nations role.
Frank, that's just a great question because the media is not reporting it. There has been a surge in belligerent behavior by Iran just over the last 2 years. You may remember that it fired missiles at a U.S. base in Iraq in January. It attacked a Saudi oil refinery last fall. And over the last 2 years, it has withdrawn from all of its obligations under Obama's fraudulent nuclear deal. And in addition, making this worse, the Israeli government stole thousands of documents on Iran's covert nuclear weapons program in 2018. And over the last couple of years, it has revealed incredible information about how Iran is engaged, actively engaged, in nuclear weapons research since the agreement was declared in 2015. And this includes, Frank, three or four facilities that the Iranians started destroying after the Israeli allegations came out. So that's why President Trump and his team have been trying to crack down at the UN against Iran right now.
Fred, one of the most worrying of the things that is afoot at the moment is the prospect that sanctions that had been in place until very recently, I guess, on Iran's access to conventional weapons imports is being sunsetted. And its friends, the Russians and the Chinese most especially, are apparently determined not to allow it to be re-upped. Talk a little bit about where that stands and how that bears on this question of snapping back the sanctions as President Trump has sought to do.
Well, under Obama's nuclear deal, conventional armed sanctions, UN sanctions, were to expire in October 2020. So given Iran's recent behavior, the Trump administration understandably said, let's extend those sanctions indefinitely. Well, the Russians and the Chinese vetoed that. So the Trump administration said, okay, we will then trigger a mechanism in a UN Security Council resolution that approved the UN deal. It's not in the UN deal. That allows the United States to snap back sanctions. What that means is, if we ask for a snapback of sanctions, a vote has to be taken to continue the sanctions waiver. That means Russia and China can't veto putting sanctions back. We can veto continuing the sanctions waiver. It's an end run around the Security Council veto. It's a little bit controversial. So, you know, we took that route. And unfortunately, our European allies stood with China and Russia and said, well, we think this is illegal because the U.S. left the nuclear deal when this provision's not in the nuclear deal. And as Mike Pompeo said, this just shows that the Europeans are once again appeasing the mullahs in Iran.
So the net effect of that betrayal, Fred Flights, would be what? That Iran gets access to conventional weapons and Iran gets to continue to be spared the effects of UN sanctions? Both of those? What?
Well, you know, it's mostly symbolic because the Trump administration has very strict sanctions on Iran and we're punishing nations who don't honor them. Why this is significant is because it validates President Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal and his America First strategy. And it allows the president to say, we were right to move ahead by ourselves on this because the Europeans were not interested in restraining Iran's nuclear program. They want to side with the globalists and the elitists and the foreign policy establishment. And President Trump said, no, sometimes we have to break with that establishment to defend our national security. We do what's right for the American people, not what the UN tells us to do.
You know, one other thing I think that it clearly validates, Fred, is the criticism that you and the Center for Security Policy and others of us expressed at the get-go on this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the assurances that, well, Barack Obama and Joe Biden and John Kerry and Ben Rhodes and others in the administration of Barack Obama insisted, well, no, sanctions will just snap back if the Iranians violate this agreement in any way. Ain't so, obviously. And this is really, again, to the point you're making that the president was right to extricate us from this deal. It's, I think, one of his most important accomplishments, and I was glad that it featured prominently in the recitation of those accomplishments in the Republican convention this past week. Fred, let me switch gears quickly. John Ratcliffe is, of course, the new Director of National Intelligence, and I just wanted to ask you quickly, there's a story that suggests we may see a lot more of the documents that have been withheld from us about the anti-Trump conspiracy at the direction of the DNI, who is going to declassify them. What can you tell us about what might be as a result in the offing?
Well, the rumor is that Ratcliffe is going to declassify a House Intelligence Committee investigative inquiry on the analytic tradecraft of an analysis of Russian meddling in an election. This is a fraudulent analysis that said Russia meddled to help Trump win. Now, I broke this story in Fox News a few months ago that the House Intelligence Committee Republicans did this report and had found stunning information that there was information, intelligence, that the Russians wanted Hillary Clinton to win. But John Brennan suppressed that information over the objections of CIA analysts and instead included weak intelligence that the Russians wanted Trump to win, also over the objections of CIA analysts. Ratcliffe, I understand, is soon going to release this report, and it will be quite a bombshell.
Well, we will be watching it closely and look forward to the chance to get your informed insights into what it means and how it fits into this larger pattern of the politicization of your old agency at the hands of John Brennan and, well, the Obama-Biden administration more generally. Fred Flights, thank you for your time today. Thanks for your leadership of the Center for Security Policy and all the great work you've done over the years on behalf of our country. Keep it up, my friend. I know you will, and I look forward to talking with you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and our duty expert on economic warfare and what is afoot in that domain at the moment. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and we're back for what is one of the most important segments of this program each week, and that is our visit inside the Economic War Room with its host, Kevin Freeman. He is, of course, the driving force behind so much of the work that's being done these days on understanding economic warfare threats, both through that program at Blaze TV, and you can find out how to subscribe to it at economicwarroom.com, but also as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm very pleased to say, and through his blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome back. Kevin, I know you're very concerned as a chartered financial analyst with a lot of experience in the markets and trading and investing there, by what seems to be a disconnect between the value of the stock market at the moment and the sort of fundamentals, the underlying condition of the economy. And I know on this program and elsewhere, you have warned that this may be setting us up for a fall. Talk about why your concerns are particularly intense in this run-up to the 2020 election.
Well, Frank, I appreciate the opportunity. I've watched the stock market for a long time. I've been in the investment game since the early 1980s. And I've seen markets rise and fall. I don't recall a time in which the disconnect was greater between the actual economic conditions that we're facing and what the market seems to be telling us. Now, there's no doubt the market may be right. Maybe there is a solution to all of our problems around the corner. All of a sudden, maybe coronavirus disappears, the rioting ceases, electorate comes together and we focus on profits, not on stakeholder values, which is what candidate Biden is talking about. And all of a sudden, maybe the market's right. Maybe things are much better economically than we've ever imagined. But when you peel behind the surface and you look down and say, all right, why is the market close to all-time highs on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and certainly at all-time highs on the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ? Why is that? You find that there are a handful of stocks, the Apples and the Teslas of the world, that just seem to go up no matter what. And I'm not predicting what's going to happen. I can't tell you with any certainty. But in the past, watching the markets, when you've seen a handful of stocks like Apple and Tesla are doing now, keep the market averages high while a lot of other companies, good fundamental parts of the economy, are lagging to such a great degree, you're either at the beginning or the end of a bull market. And given the fact that we've had a 50% run up in just a few months, I would suggest that it might be we're more closer to the end. And that is a risk, especially with the election coming and the fact that our number one adversary, China, has said a single man-made stock market crash is one of their key concept weapons.
And the defeat of Donald Trump is one of their high priorities. And the experience, and you chronicle it in your first best-selling book, Secret Weapon, that the market can be manipulated, all suggests that under present circumstances especially, the Chinese have both the motive and apparently the requisite skills to do incalculable harm to the stock market's value in this country. And that incentive can only be the greater because practically every day the president points to the high value of the stock market and 401ks and so on as a great accomplishment and a basis for his reelection. So all of that does not seem to augur well for avoiding a manipulated intentional crash at the hands of our enemy.
Well, if you look at it, that when they talk about a new concept weapon, how could they do it? Unfortunately, because most of the trading on the stock exchanges is done by high frequency trading, the Chinese have the ability to influence the feeds that go into the high frequency trades either by hacking or other manipulations. And you could push a news item or a news story that would cause the trading algorithms to all of a sudden start a cascade sale of the markets. That's how vulnerable that we actually are. And to your point, Frank, you're right. Historically, the party that's in power loses power from the White House if there's a market crash within 2 or 3 months of the election. And we saw it in 2008. We've seen it throughout history. And that is well documented and well understood by the Chinese. And so this is something we should watch out for. I'm not predicting the stock market. I'm not trying to give investment advice in any way or any kind here. But it is something that we should be mindful of as we watch the economy slowly recover, but the stock market bounce back so rapidly.
So, Kevin Freeman, the question occurs, and we've talked about this before, but I want to give you an opportunity to expand on it a bit in light of this very ominous prognosis. What can the United States government do at this moment that might mitigate the danger of this kind of manipulated but predictable crash of the stock market?
Well, basically take away the ability for the trading programs to just have a cascade selling effect and crash a market. And the way to do that is you reinstate something that was in place, put in place by the SEC in the mid-1930s and ran until 2007. It's called the uptick rule, and it just says you cannot short sell a stock unless the last trade was higher. And it's a very simple rule. They've tried to they eliminated it in 2007. They realized it was a mistake. They've tried to put a fake version of it in place that doesn't work very well. But if they go back to the old rule, that's the first thing. And the second thing is that you shouldn't be able to allow sell stock that you don't own unless you borrow it first. You shouldn't be able to just sell something you don't own just betting that the price is going down. And unfortunately, the naked short selling rules have not been fairly enforced or very well enforced in the past, 15 years or so.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, this is one of the things that I have to say. My head kind of exploded at when I read your book, Secret Weapon, and how this was done in the past. It seems unimaginable that anybody could sell the stock of a company without actually owning the stock or actually even borrowing the stock physically or in a financial sense from somebody else. This is the so-called naked short selling that you believe was the instrument of the last takedown back in 2008 that contributed to, as you've indicated, Barack Obama's election. And even more stunning to me was the name of the rule that made that possible. Tell our audience who's credited with that bizarre arrangement.
Well, there's a rule called the Madoff rule that was put in place because Bernie Madoff was very close with the Securities Exchange Commission for many years. And the rule was essentially if you're a broker dealer and you wanted to allow someone to sell something or you wanted to sell to a client to allow for shares to exist, you could just make up the shares, sell them to your client, and then over time you would go back and get them. And that would prevent wild swings in the market. That was the theory behind it. But what that allowed is a broker-dealer or someone who had those credentials or borrowed those credentials to literally sell a bunch of shares of a stock that they'd never have owned, don't own, really have no intention of owning. And if you do enough of that, you sell enough of them, the price goes down so low that the company might have to declare bankruptcy. Now, Walmart doesn't have to because Walmart sells goods and services and has a real business. But there are a lot of financial banks, for example, Lehman Brothers and others, that depend on capital lines on a daily basis. And if you cut off their capital lines, they can't stay in business. And those were the ones targeted in 2008. And I have little doubt that those would be ones targeted in another attack.
The first clue, of course, that there's a problem here is that a guy who is now serving a life sentence for fraud in the stock markets is the architect of this particular arrangement. And if it hasn't been fixed and there is no uptick rule in place, then we're sitting ducks, it seems to me. And I encourage our audience to go to school on this. Check out Kevin Freeman's great work on it at economicwarroom.com and globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin, let me talk about a couple of other pieces of what's going on in the markets very quickly. The United States government last week sanctioned 24 Chinese companies, basically for their involvement in building out bastions in the South China Sea, meant to be the basis upon which they would control that strategic waterway. This week, the Pentagon, just yesterday in fact, announced that several of those companies, including the biggest of them, Chinese Communications Construction Corporation, we call it C4, is actually a Chinese military company doing business in the United States. So here you have a sanctioned Chinese company, a mainstay of its military industrial complex, and it's actually making money here in America and taking money out of our capital markets. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, it goes to the saying that we repeat all the time. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. The Chinese, as they published in the book Unrestricted Warfare in 1999, recognized that and subverting banking stock markets was a part of unrestricted warfare. And they've done it masterfully. They've done it with the help and support of many politicians here, including Vice President Biden, who's candidate for president now, who was a part of the memorandum of understanding that allowed Chinese companies to enter our markets without giving us access to their accounting. Why wouldn't they want us to see their accounting? Well, two reasons. One is either it's fraudulent, as has been proven the case in multiple Chinese companies, or they're doing things that we wouldn't support, as is the case of these companies that have been sanctioned by our government. They want to hide the accounting so that people don't know what they own and they don't realize that they're funding our own demise.
Kevin Freeman, thank you for this quick tour de raison in your portfolio, The Economic War Room. I do hope our audience will check out both the programs that you do at Blaze TV as well as the battle plans that you generate after each one. They're really invaluable. Kevin, I know you'll keep up your good work, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Spencer about the jihadist element of the enemy within. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're joined by one of my favorite people. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of an incredibly important project called Jihad Watch at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is the author of more books than I can count, to be honest, and many of them are bestsellers. They lay out in incredibly clear and readily accessible language some of the most important national security and public policy challenges of our time, particularly those arising from, well, what I think of as Sharia supremacism, the doctrine of authoritative Islam that is, well, the source of jihad, among other things. He is the author most recently of a brand new Center for Security Policy Press book entitled Mass Migration in Europe, a Model for the U.S. We are going to have Robert on to talk about that at length in a full hour program quite soon. But for the moment today, we wanted to catch up with him on a different and very pressing topic. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back for that purpose. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Let's drill down on something that is not getting much attention other than from your good self and your tireless work at Jihad Watch, Robert, and that is the presence in the mix of the enemies within, as I think of them, of this country, the various Marxist groups primarily, some doing business as Antifa, some doing business as Black Lives Matter organization, and other assorted front groups, some associated with the Chinese Communist Party, it seems. But largely unnoted in their midst are these, well, jihadists, adherents to Sharia supremacism, the Muslim Brotherhood's various fronts. What can you tell us about their presence in this sort of revolutionary cabal and how they are conducting themselves at the moment?
It's been a remarkable convergence and a vivid illustration of what's often been noted, the leftist Islamic alliance.
We call it the red-green axis at the center, of course.
And we've seen the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which, of course, is abundantly documented as having ties to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, cheering on the riots and calling on people to participate in them. And there have been some telling individual incidents, including a lawyer in New York City, Uruj Rahman, a Muslim woman who has worked with Palestinian causes and written about the alleged injustices of Israel, actually throwing a Molotov cocktail into an NYPD cruiser during one of the riots in New York. Also, a Muslim migrant from Bosnia, Zinan Kajmovic, who actually stabbed an NYPD cop in the neck during one of these riots. And of course, this is in line with the hateful and incendiary rhetoric that we're seeing against police all over the country. And while he did it, though, this man was crying Allahu Akbar. And he later explained at a hearing that he said, "My religion made me do it." And so he makes no bones about the fact that this is indeed, he is a warrior, one could say, of the red-green axis. And there are many other such examples.
And the thing that has always puzzled people when folks like you and I talk with them about this phenomenon is that it's clear that there are very different end states in mind. On the one hand, the Marxists have in mind a totalitarian system under their control that would essentially prohibit religions and, you know, raise up this ideological elite to govern. On the other hand, the Islamists have a different kind of totalitarianism, to be sure, but one that is sort of theocratic in mind, do they not? How do the twain meet? How do they make common cause, Robert Spencer?
Well, I think that what's most revealing about these riots is that it confirms something that many people have observed for years, and that is that the common cause that they have united on is hatred of America, hatred of the West, hatred of Judeo-Christian civilization, the desire, indeed, as you note, for a totalitarian regime. They share a hatred for the freedom of speech and a desire to stamp out all dissent. They both want authoritarian regimes. And so they see each other as deeply allied on the ideological level, despite their differences, which are actually more superficial.
Is it fair to say, though, that it's more likely than not a marriage of convenience, that at the end of the day, they're still going to seek their preferred end state? And if they survive and prevail over the United States, and at the moment, I think they will have a sorting out to do, in which there will probably be a bloody internecine fight between the members of this axis. Would there not be?
Yeah, I don't have any doubt about that. It's a happy alliance, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be a marriage, and there will be conflict between the two. I think the most notable example of that is in Iran, where when the Shah was being toppled, the Tudeh party, the Marxist party in Iran, allied with Khomeini and thought that they would enter into a coalition with Khomeini to govern Iran after the Shah was gone. But instead, Khomeini turned on them and put them in prison. And this is what the left has to look forward to, but they're largely not aware of it.
Would your money be on the jihadis rather than the leftists when the great sorting takes out?
In the long run, because we're dealing with very patient people who believe that they're fighting a 1,400-year war, and they believe that if they lose, then their children will win, or their children's children. They just keep coming and never stop. And so at some point, even if the left prevails initially, they will be overwhelmed.
And part of that conviction is, of course, born of the idea that it is Allah's will, that it is divinely mandated that they will prevail. So that does give one a certain degree of tenacity, especially if the reward for it is, you know, paradise and 72 virgins and all that. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, Robert. The government of Turkey is said to be very actively involved these days, much more so than I think the Saudis were in the past, as a sort of sponsor of and enabler for the Muslim Brotherhood and its Sharia supremacist agenda in the United States. Do you see evidence of that? And would that essentially constitute one of perhaps several different examples, the Chinese Communist Party comes to mind as well, of foreign involvement in this revolutionary movement inside America at the moment?
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any doubt that this movement has very deep roots, that we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg, and that it's very likely that there are international groups that are supporting it. The Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan is very much connected with the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, as you and I well know, the Muslim Brotherhood is deeply embedded in numerous institutions and agencies, even of the U.S. government. And so it seems to me to be something that is, although I don't have direct evidence of it, I wouldn't be in the least surprised if it turned out that a lot of this was being bankrolled by Brotherhood interests, by Turkish interests, by others that clearly do not have the best interests of the U.S. at heart. Absolutely.
That's for sure. even some that we profess are our allies, like the Turks and the Qataris. They are working very much against us, I think, in various ways, including these. Finally, Robert Spencer, let me ask you about the confidence that you have at the moment that the law enforcement agencies of the United States, whether it's the FBI, our preeminent federal agency for this purpose, or the Department of Homeland Security, or even the Defense Department, are really clued up about this jihadist phenomenon in the United States and steeled against it? Or is it the case that, as it certainly has been in the recent past, at least, they're completely fixated on and distracted by this so-called white supremacist phenomenon?
Yeah, it's unfortunately the case that they're completely myopic. The white supremacist threat is minuscule compared to the jihad threat, but Islamic advocacy groups tied to the Brotherhood, like CARE, the Islamic Society of North America, and others, have prevailed upon people at high levels of the U.S. government to think that it's racist and Islamophobic and bigoted to look too deeply into the jihad threat. And consequently, they've hamstrung our efforts to resist it, particularly in its nonviolent manifestations, which essentially don't exist as far as our intelligence and law enforcement agencies are concerned. They're doing nothing to stop infiltration, penetration, espionage even. It's really an appalling situation that dates back to the Obama administration, when he forbade any connection of Islam with terrorism in counterterror training materials. And that attitude, which is completely contrary to reality, since the terrorists themselves will tell you that their motives are rooted in Islamic doctrine, it still prevails among many, all too many people in intelligence and law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, and to our great peril, we ought to be clear about this. When we have a situation in which 100-plus cities in this country have been put to the torch or otherwise upended by revolutionary violence, and it all seemed to be a great surprise to the law enforcement agencies of this country, particularly the FBI, tells you something is dreadfully wrong, and it may be compounded by the fact that they're not paying close attention to the real problem in our midst, and that is partly the red and partly the green, the Marxists as well as the Islamists. Robert Spencer, thank you for being so clear-eyed about all of this and keeping us apprised of it. We appreciate you doing so here at Secure Freedom Radio and look forward to talking with you at length in the near future about your new book, Mass Migration in Europe, A Model for the United States. We'll look forward to that and much more with you, Robert. God bless you. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Michael Cutler, former Immigration and Naturalization Service line officer, about this enemy within problem and what we best be doing about it, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Michael Cutler, a retired senior special agent in what was then called the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He is the host of the Michael Cutler Hour that can be heard on Blog Talk Radio, and a very active contributor to outfits like PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. In fact, I'm very pleased to catch up with him in connection with one particularly important piece that he just published at Front Page. Michael, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us. Michael, you wrote about something that you headlined, Radical Democrats Have Become the Adversaries of Freedom. And I wanted to ask you, yesterday we were treated to the Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, former vice president of the United States, visiting my old hometown, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to deliver a short message in which he blamed Donald Trump for the rioting that has been taking place across America. That would seem to be at odds with your own analysis of the situation. What did you make of that speech, and where does the truth lie?
With Joe Biden, the truth is a moving target. You know, when I used to interrogate the bad guys I arrested, I would always tell them, let's get to the truth and not waste time because there's only one version of the truth. Look, I'm waiting for Joe Biden to declare that Trump is responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs. The bottom line, you know, he takes one position one day, another position another day, and we have him on videotape, whether it was fracking, whether it was immigration. And if you look at immigration, it's not 11 million. Most universities acknowledge 25 million, and the number nobody ever talks about. And folks, this is critical. Pay attention to what I'm about to tell you. The Biden plan and the chameleon Harris, she's also a chameleon, chameleon Harris plan, would allow maybe 30 million aliens to get green cards, but that's only the tip of the iceberg, because under the law, they could immediately bring in every single one of their minor children. So you could be looking at the entry of tens of millions of children who would flood our schools and then join the labor pool, while Joe Biden says, I'm going to create more jobs and increase wages. That's not physically possible. You know, it's one statement after another that when you scratch beneath the surface, all you see are lies and fake and false promises. And when we look at this issue of national security,
That's what I want to get to with you, Michael. You've devoted your professional life to protecting our nation's security, often at the borders of this country, but also you have an appreciation for the enemies within that I think is both very needed and singular in a way. Talk a little bit, if you would, based on your expertise, about what we've seen taking place on America's streets that is, again, being characterized by the Democrats at the moment, I guess having figured out that this is not polling well, as Trump's fault, as it's been so much else. What is your professional judgment of who are these people who are rioting, who are burning, looting, and otherwise, in some cases, killing people in our streets?
So let's cut to the chase. The bottom line is JFK gave a speech way back on May 25th, 1961, just 20 days after Alan Shepard became the first American in space. We're talking almost 6 decades ago. And he warned about how an insurgency in emerging democracies is undermining the rise of democracy and freedom throughout the world. And when you look at the tactics that Kennedy warned about in that speech before a joint session in Congress, those are the very same tactics that are being used right now within the borders of the United States of America. And the Democrats have done nothing to stop the violence. They don't care about the loss of life, but now that the polls are sinking, they do care about votes. They don't care about what I call collateral damage. And if you look at what Kennedy had to say, I thought it was rather brilliant, because he said this, and think about where we are, okay? They, meaning our enemies, China, Russia, the communist countries, possess powerful intercontinental striking force, large force, conventional war, well-trained underground, we call them sleepers today, in nearly every country, the power to conscript talent and manpower for any purpose, the capacity for quick decisions, a closed society without dissent or free information, think of the fake news, and long experience in the techniques of violence and subversion. What have we been seeing? And this is what really caught my eye. They make the most of their scientific successes, their economic progress, they pose as a foe of colonialism. That's the word that AOC, in fact, used. And friend of popular revolution, they prey on unstable and unpopular governments, unsealed or unknown boundaries, meaning what? Open borders, unfulfilled hopes, convulsive change, massive poverty, illiteracy, unrest, and frustration. That comes across the border with people who are not fluent in the English language. Many are illiterate, many are poverty-stricken. And so you look at all this, and so you understand that the tactics that we feared being used overseas are now coming home to roost. And finally, here's something that he also warned about, and this is really important. Experience has taught us that no nation has the power or the wisdom to solve all the problems of the world, that any initiative carries with it the risk of temporary defeat, that nuclear weapons cannot prevent dispersion, that no free people can be kept free without the will and energy of their own. By the way, Kennedy also warned about zones being established within a sovereign nation to spread dissension and subversion. Didn't we have the CHOP zone in Seattle? So everything that Kennedy said parallels everything that we're witnessing being carried out across the country by Democrat regimes at the city and state level. The sanctuary cities are a perfect example of that.
So, Michael Cutler, what you've basically laid out here is in the words of John Kennedy, the communist playbook. This is the Marxist strategy for taking down free societies. Point one, that's what we're up against, is really a Marxist revolution, isn't it?
Nothing short of that. And they don't care about the collateral damage. They also worry about the tactics of the stores being destroyed. It brings to mind Kristallnacht, when Jewish storekeepers were attacked today. There is a divide between blacks and whites being created by the same Marxists to put Americans at odds with each other. You know, I have to tell you, I don't believe that there's systemic racism in America, and more whites than blacks are shot by police. But here's a question for you and your audience. When was the last time you saw television coverage of a white person who was shot by a police officer? You don't see it. So they foment this dissension within the ranks, if you will, and undermine the sense of community that Americans always used to share and must continue to share.
The media, of course, is highly complicit in this Marxist revolution, I think it's fair to say. But let me just ask you, Michael, I'm very pleased that you brought up John Kennedy here, because if he were to give that speech today, of course, he would be roundly denounced by the Democratic Party for racism and bigotry and xenophobia and a hostility to, I don't know, diversity, whatever else you want to throw at it. This really says a lot about how far the Democratic Party has migrated from those roots. And there are still many Americans alive. I myself was a Scoop Jackson Democrat who remember that party, but it's not the one that is in the political sphere today, is it? And this gets to your point about, you know, has the Democratic Party itself become an adversary of freedom?
Well, I believe that it has. Certainly the radical leadership. Now, there are individual mayors and governors and congresspeople who are Democrats who oppose what is going on. But you have to look at the leadership. You know, people dismissed, to understand when everyone says, oh, I don't take the PAC money, the politicians. Yes, they do. Because when they want to run for office, the party gets the PAC money and they distribute it to their favorite candidates. If they buck the mainstream, so-called mainstream radicalized Democrat leadership, guess what happens? They don't get funding for their campaigns. Both parties do this. That's how they control their people. Think about the position of the whip in Congress. Doesn't that sound like a Tony Soprano enforcer?
It sure does. It often is, as you say. But ultimately, it does come down to that, the money, doesn't it? It's all about who is going to get campaign support from the party, and so they toe the line. But I guess what I'm really getting at here, Michael, is how extreme that line has become, and how really it's not just absurd, but it's obscene to have people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and the Democratic operatives that write their stuff now trying to put onto Donald Trump the blame for what clearly their policies, some of them the Democratic mayors, the Democratic governors and so on, most especially at their level, have been doing to foment and certainly tolerate and thereby enable what's happening.
To put it bluntly, I'm sorry to cut you off, but to put it bluntly, Frank, what we're seeing is what a teacher I used to have in high school called projective reality. Whatever they claim Trump is doing, they're doing. Whether it's taking down our democracy, which they're screaming about, it's them. Whether they say, well, Trump wouldn't leave office, you have Hillary saying to Joe Biden, no matter how the outcome of the election, no matter what the outcome of the election is, don't concede.
Michael Cutler, thank you so much for your time today, for joining us. Come back to us again if you would soon, and for your great service to our country, which continues these days at places like Front Page Magazine. Check it out. And also the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.